and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from Religion News Service, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News by wishing a Happy New Year to our listeners of the Jewish faith as the Hebrew year 5782 began this past Monday. And in preparation for Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, an article was published on September 5th in the Washington Post. And this article was entitled, "Pandemic Has Been a Spiritual Boon for Some, and Rosh Hashanah 2021 Shows What's Changed." This article is by Michelle Boorstein of the Washington Post. Barry Ryan Tuneman was a spiritual seeker for decades, looking for a deep Jewish spirituality guided by socially liberal ethics. It took the pandemic for her to find it. Tuneman, 52, once lived in an ashram, or spiritual retreat center, and years later tried to start a havura, or lay-led Jewish community, outside Seattle. But logistics like commuting and the rush of parenting two kids got in the way of finding something that felt right. Suddenly, in March 2020, Tuneman, a childbirth educator, she specializes in helping people who have had difficult birth experiences, was stuck at home where life shrank and slowed. The circumstances proved fertile. Tuneman began connecting with Talmud study groups on Facebook, taking a course exploring 10th century Jewish ethics on Zoom, stopping driving and using technology on the Sabbath, and perhaps most importantly, launching a small monthly women's group centered on the moon, the Jewish calendar, and ancient Jewish beliefs about natural cycles and patterns. The Hebrew Bible establishes the Jewish calendar as based on the moon and calls for Jews to celebrate the new moon each month. The practice is called Rosh Chodesh, or New Month, or Head of the Month. "My spirituality has increased hundredsfold because of the pandemic, because everything under the sun became accessible online. If it wasn't for the pandemic, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to turn inward as much as I did and slow down," she said, her voice breaking. "It helped me to prioritize the things that really were the most important to me in my heart. It changed my journey." For millions of Americans, the coronavirus pandemic has changed the course of their spiritual journeys. Some have shut off completely, questioning their faith beliefs and practices, while others have maintained a steady connection to their regular religious communities or routines, more often online than in person. Still others have dove into new, deep religiosities. For some Jews, the arrival this month of another Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the second time these holidays have been observed during the pandemic, offers concrete evidence that this period has changed them. Tuneman's newfound focus on the cycles of the moon means a different way of observing Rosh Hashanah, which stretches from Monday at sundown to Wednesday and marks the beginning of the Jewish calendar year. It's one of the most common times of the year when U.S. Jews attend synagogue. Going to services used to be the main way Tuneman observed the holiday, which calls for self-reflection, repentance, and betterment. This year, her observance centers on her Rosh Chodesh women's group, and she will virtually join a new synagogue where she recently became a member that focuses on meditation. The group of eight spread across the western United States gathered Thursday on Zoom, where for 90 minutes they discussed the specific spiritual energy of the new month, called Tishrei, lit candles, and talked about how Judaism discusses infertility. They tied the topic to the holiday, since the new year is a time when Jews are called to think more about their goals, and for some, expanding their family is part of that. Research about the impacts of the pandemic on religious and spiritual life in America is still evolving. At The Well, the D.C.-based group that organizes small Rosh Chodesh groups like Tuneman's, found that the pandemic magnified interest in environmental-based spiritual practices that already existed. "The number of women contacting the group since March 2020 has multiplied 30 times," said Sarah Waxman, At The Well's founder and a member of a Rosh Chodesh group for more than 5 years. "There are at least 230 well circles across the globe," she said, "with the pandemic significantly expanding participants from mostly millennials to mainly women over 45. "I never considered doing women's circles online before the pandemic," Waxman said. "I thought the richness of it and the energy of being together with other people meant you really needed to be together in person. I was wrong and blown away that you don't need to do that. People are looking for spirituality, belonging, and connection like never before. During the pandemic, Waxman saw some in-person circles disband because people moved, but then even more would come together as people became more open to doing it online. Some are just coming together in person this fall because of vaccinations and are marking Tishrei, the first month of the Jewish year, which includes Rosh Hashanah and means New Year or Head of the Year. Nicole Qualam, 37, a lawyer in Durham, North Carolina, couldn't imagine what her monthly well circle would feel like online. Her group of about a dozen women started up in March 2019 with what she describes as an explosion of wine and glitters and candles all over the hostess's house. This circle is an embarrassment of specialness. Being together in person, in a women-led, women-only group, connecting intensely through prayer and practices that are ancient, she said, is part of what helped her see how Judaism can continue to be relevant and fruitful and alive and, frankly, female, feminine. The group had seen her through a divorce, through others' marriages, miscarriages, and fertility issues. When someone was going to give birth, we'd wrap her in prayer and love and witchiness. But when the pandemic started and everything went online, giving up the group wasn't an option, she said, even though she doesn't like Zoom and doesn't do it with other friends. Now online, they plan spiritual practices for the group and drop things off at one another's homes to use during the circles, such as pastel crayons for coloring, face masks, or copies of books to discuss. The digital circles were very comforting, especially when things were very scary and very isolated, Qualin said. The pandemic, she said, revealed to her that the well circle was not really an add-on to traditional things she'd done, such as attend synagogue. It was her primary Jewish community. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah, while in the past she would have attended synagogue services, this year she'll probably take her two small daughters to an outdoor shofar-blowing event, and on September 12th mark the new year and new month with her well circle at a fireside discussion. During the pandemic, the Rosh Chodesh group was a very special, safe, supportive place to continue to have spiritual connection and community, she said. After the pandemic, some of the more traditional rabbi congregation-based things will probably continue to be a part of my life in different seasons, but the spiritual sustenance of the group feels much more rich and immediately nourishing. Kara McGee, who lives in Temecula, California, says the pandemic and being able to go online was a game-changer for her faith. The Jewish community where she lives is very small, she said, and divided further among multiple synagogues. The period of the pandemic was also politically divisive, including at the school district, where she works as a risk management director. She was already comfortable with spiritual work online because she is studying for an adult bat mitzvah with a rabbi in Colorado. So when she heard about a totally virtual Rosh Chodesh group, she thought, this is going to be Jewish, positive, and we aren't going to talk about petty disagreements like those she sometimes saw at her local synagogue. She began attending her synagogue online in New York City and her bat mitzvah's rabbi's services in Denver. She also badly wanted something healing during the pandemic and always was drawn to spiritualities that were nature-based and women-centered. The virtual At the Well circle she joined a year ago is like oxygen. I don't know if I could have done the pandemic without it. She has started another one in person in Temecula. McGee is also attending two well groups and not attending synagogue for Rosh Hashanah. She also hopes to participate in one of the outside aspects of the holiday, such as a practice called Tashlich, which involves prayers and casting sins and apologies into a moving body of water in the form of breadcrumbs, and, of course, listening to the shofar being blown. It's not that traditional in-person Jewish practices don't hold meaning, she said. She recently attended a small bar mitzvah at a synagogue. It was emotional to be in front of the Torah again and to hold it. I don't think online will ever replace in person, but it's definitely supplementing it, she said. We'll turn next to an article from the August 26th edition of the New York Times. Actually, it was in print on August 27th. And the headline on this article is, The New Chief Chaplain at Harvard? An Atheist. The subheadline, The Elevation of Greg Epstein, author of Good Without God, reflects a broader trend of young people who increasingly identify as spiritual but religiously non-affiliated. This article is by Emma Goldberg of the New York Times. The Puritan colonists who settled in New England in the 1630s had a nagging concern about the churches they were building. How would they ensure that the clergymen would be literate? Their answer was Harvard University, a school that was established to educate the ministry and adopted the motto, Truth for Christ in the Church. It was named after a pastor, John Harvard, and it would be more than 70 years before the school had a president who was not a clergyman. Nearly four centuries later, Harvard's Organization of Chaplains has elected as its next president an atheist named Greg Epstein, who takes on the job this week. Mr. Epstein, 44, author of the book Good Without God, is a seemingly unusual choice for the role. He will coordinate the activities of more than 40 university chaplains who lead the Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, and other religious communities on campus. Yet many Harvard students, some raised in families of faith, others never quite certain how to label their religious identities, attest to the influence that Mr. Epstein has had on their spiritual lives. There is a rising group of people who no longer identify with any religious tradition, but still experience a real need for conversation and support around what it means to be a good human and live an ethical life, said Mr. Epstein, who was raised in a Jewish household and has been Harvard's humanist chaplain since 2005, teaching students about the progressive movement that centers people's relationships with one another instead of with God. To Mr. Epstein's fellow campus chaplains, at least, the notion of being led by an atheist is not as counterintuitive as it might sound. His election was unanimous. Maybe in a more conservative university climate there might be a question like, what the heck are they doing at Harvard having a humanist be the president of the chaplains, said Margaret Hammerstrom, the Christian Science chaplain at Harvard. But in this environment it works. Greg is known for wanting to keep lines of communication open between different faiths. The dozens of students whom Mr. Epstein mentors have found a source of meaning in the school's organization of humanists, atheists, and agnostics, reflecting a broader trend of young people across the United States who increasingly identify as spiritual but religiously non-affiliated. That trend might be especially salient at Harvard. A Harvard Crimson survey of the class of 2019 found that those students were two times more likely to identify as atheist or agnostic than 18-year-olds in the general population. Greg's leadership isn't about theology, said Charlotte Nickerson, 20, an electrical engineering student. It's about cooperation between people of different faiths and bringing together people who wouldn't normally consider themselves religious. The Harvard chaplains play an outsized role on campus, touching hundreds of students' lives, whether through mass offered by the Catholic Student Center or Shabbat dinners at Harvard Hillel. Its leader reports directly to the office of the university president. To Mr. Epstein, becoming the organization's head, especially as it gains more recognition from the university, comes as affirmation of a years-long effort started by his predecessor to teach a campus with traditional religious roots about humanism. We don't look to a God for answers, Mr. Epstein says. We are each other's answers. Mr. Epstein's work includes hosting dinners for undergraduates where a conversation goes deep. Does God exist? What is the meaning of life? He previously ran a congregation of Boston-area humanists and atheists who met in Harvard Square for weekly services that centered on secular sermons. In 2018, he closed that down to focus his time on building campus relationships, including at MIT, where he is also a chaplain. Mr. Epstein frequently meets individually with students who are struggling with issues both personal and theological, counseling them on managing anxiety about summer jobs, family feuds, the pressures of social media, and the turbulence endemic to college life. Greg is irreverent and good at diffusing pressure, Ms. Nickerson said, recalling a time he joked that if her summer internship got too stressful, she could always get fired. Then she would have a good story to share. Some of the students drawn to Mr. Epstein's secular community are religious refugees, people raised in observant households who arrive at college seeking spiritual meaning in a less rigid form. Adele Goldenberg, 22, grew up in the Hasidic community in Brooklyn, where she recalls being told that she could not attend college. In preschool, when asked what she wanted to be when she grew up, her answer was simple, a bride. It was the only thing she could envision for a girl like herself. When she turned 19, she applied to Harvard in secret and fled the community. Once at Harvard, she was wary of assuming any religious label, but she still yearned to find people wrestling with deeper issues than academic achievement. She started attending meetings in the humanist group and discovered in Mr. Epstein a form of mentorship that felt almost like having a secular rabbi, she said. When the pandemic hit, I was like, Greg, do you have time to talk about the meaning of life? Ms. Goldenberg recalled. He showed me that it's possible to find community outside a traditional religious context, that you can have the value add religion has provided for centuries, which is that it's there when things seem chaotic. Ms. Goldenberg reflected anew on how unlikely her path had been when her mother asked to see the university yearbook. I told her, I don't think you're going to like it, Ms. Goldenberg said. It says I was co-president of the Harvard Humanists, Atheists, and Agnostics, and you can see my shoulders. Non-religiosity is on the rise far beyond the confines of Harvard. It is the fastest-growing religious preference in the country, according to the Pew Research Center. More than 20% of the country identifies as atheist, agnostic, or non-religious, called the nuns, including 4 in 10 millennials. The reasons that more young Americans are disaffiliating in the world's most religious developed country are varied. The Notre Dame sociologist Christian Smith attributes the trend partly to the growing alliance between the Republican Party and the Christian right, a decline of trust in institutions, growing skepticism of religion in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks, and a shift away from traditional family structures that centered on churchgoing. Mr. Epstein's community has tapped into the growing desire for meaning without faith in God. Being able to find values in rituals but not having to believe in magic, that's a powerful thing, said A.J. Kumar, who served as the president of a Harvard humanist graduate student group that Mr. Epstein advised. Other Harvard chaplains have applauded Mr. Epstein's efforts to provide a campus home for those who are religiously unattached, skeptical, but still searching. Some said his selection to lead the group following its previous Jewish leader seemed obvious. Greg was the first choice of a committee that was made up of a Lutheran, a Christian Scientist, an evangelical Christian, and a Baha'i, said the Reverend Kathleen Reed, a Lutheran chaplain who chaired the nominating committee. We're presenting to the university a vision of how the world could work when diverse traditions focus on how to be good humans and neighbors. And for some members of Harvard's humanist and atheist community, exploring humanism has brought with it a richer understanding of faith. Ms. Nickerson grew up in a working-class Catholic household where she struggled to connect with rituals at Mass. But during her freshman year at Harvard, she found herself capable of long, lively conversations with her devout grandmother. Ms. Nickerson realized that her involvement with Harvard humanism had given her the language to understand her grandmother's theology. Last spring, the two were tending roses and daylilies in the family garden when they got on the topic of surrender. Ms. Nickerson's grandmother reflected on the aspects of her life that were in God's hands. Ms. Nickerson agreed that it was important to recognize all the events beyond human control, though she does not believe there is a deity involved. Ms. Nickerson then shared a Buddhist parable that she had learned from the Humanist Club, which her grandmother later passed on to her Bible study group. We understood the idea of surrender in a similar way, even though one of those explanations came with God and the other didn't, Ms. Nickerson said. I find I'm more fluid in my spiritual conversations now. We'll continue on religion in the news with an article published on Religion News Service on September 2nd. This article is entitled, Pope Francis is Preparing a Radical Reform of the Church's Power Structures. In October, Francis is set to inaugurate a 3-year synodal preparation process that has the potential to revolutionize the way decisions are made in the Catholic Church and promote a more decentralized structure of authority. This article is by Claire Giangrave of Religion News Service, Dateline Vatican City. In 2001, Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio was a rapporteur for the Summit of Bishops of the Vatican, and he did not like what he saw. The Catholic Church had adopted a top-to-bottom approach that stripped local churches of any decision-making power, and the Synod of Bishops was reduced to nothing more than a stamp of approval for prepackaged conclusions made in Rome. When Bergoglio emerged as Pope Francis in the 2013 conclave, the synodal process was high on his list for reform. There was a cardinal who told us what should be discussed and what should not, Francis said, about his experience at the 2001 General Synod in an interview with the Argentine newspaper La Nación in 2014. That will not happen now, he added. On October 9th and 10th, Pope Francis will inaugurate a 3-year preparation process for the 2023 Synod, which will focus on reforming the synodal process. The preparation process and the 2023 Synod, with the theme For a Synodal Church, Communion, Participation, and Mission, have the potential to revolutionize the way decisions are made in the Catholic Church and promote a more decentralized structure of authority. If people just think about this as a meeting on meetings, they are so missing the point, said the Reverend David McCallum, Executive Director of the Program for Discerning Leadership of the Gregorian University in Rome and a member of the Synod Commission on Methodology, in an interview with Religion News Service. The 3-year synodal review process will take place in 3 phases: a local phase at the diocesan and parish level, a continental phase engaging bishops' conferences around the world, and a universal phase when bishops and lay people will convene in Rome to discuss the findings and topics developed in the first 2 phases. To coordinate and guide the entire process, Pope Francis created a 5-member steering committee flanked by 2 commissions on methodology and theology. The hierarchical structure Pope Francis eschewed at the Vatican in 2001 is currently reflected in Catholic dioceses across the globe. Throughout history, it became very natural that bishops, who were often the most educated and prepared leaders in the particular region where the church was, exercised their leadership as a mayor would. Speaking to La Nación, Francis said, "Church governance is in my hands after I receive the necessary advice." Far from an authoritarian imposition, synod organizers say the role of the pope is that of guaranteeing unity, which helps distinguish synodality from a parliamentary debate. The goal of the methodology commission in the first phase is to provide dioceses and parishes with guidelines that promote spaces for dialogue among all members of the community, lay, religious, and the disaffiliated. Bishops will be asked to appoint a reference person whose job it is to facilitate and create opportunities for encounter. By instructing people on individual and communal discernment, the synod will have a formational quality to it before people enter it, McCallum said. In Venezuela, Rafael Luciani, full professor at the Andres Bello Catholic University in Caracas and extraordinarius at the School of Theology and Ministry of Boston College, tackles synodality in the Latin American context. Luciani is a lay theologian and a member of the Synod's Commission for Theology. His job, ahead of the inauguration of the synodal process in Rome, is to coordinate seminars that engage the whole Latin American church. By placing a magnifying glass on local parishes, Luciani hopes to find an engaging model that can then be applied to dioceses and bishops' conferences worldwide. Ultimately, the 2023 Synod will likely change power dynamics and relationships in the Catholic Church, but the change has to come from local churches, not from Rome, Luciani told RNS. Inverting the pyramidal structure of the Catholic Church may be frightening for some, proponents admit, raising concerns that the Vatican will become nothing more than a bureaucratic step in the Church's decision-making process, or worse still, akin to a non-governmental organization. Instead, the new synodal process is a spiral, Luciani explained, where at every phase the decisions are sent from the dioceses to the episcopal conferences to Rome and then back again. For the first time there is an interaction. It is not a linear way of proceeding, he added. This new ecclesial culture is the real novelty of the synod, according to Luciani, but doubts remain in the local churches, where the biggest question, according to Luciani, is the question of authority. Authority is closely tied to clericalism, a perversion of the priesthood, as Pope Francis puts it, which also induces lay people into believing those who have received the priestly ministry are above the fold, especially in the exercise of power. Financial corruption, immorality, and sexual abuse by clergy are just a few examples of the consequences of an untouchable clergy. With synodality, Pope Francis hopes to break from a tradition that has inexorably tied power in the Catholic Church to members of the clergy. Synodality sets out to renew the power structures that have characterized the Catholic Church for centuries, but to do so it must achieve a far more ambitious goal, teaching faithful, lay and religious, to come together in dialogue at a time when entrenchment and polarization have turned Pope Francis's culture of encounter into a quasi-utopian and, ironically, divisive concept. In this effort, the synod goes beyond Pope Paul VI's vision and Pope John Paul II's and Pope Benedict XVI's different ways of proceeding, and even beyond the first synods of Pope Francis, Luciani said. Nation-states also struggle to reconcile the differences of local realities with an increasingly centralized world. Countries such as Hungary, Poland, Brazil, Russia, the Philippines, and even the United States have shifted toward a more authoritarian way by trying to establish order as a defense against chaos and uncertainty, McCallum said. The Church, an organization rooted in faith, needs to have a better track record than resorting to top-down authority, he added. Members of the Synod Commissions are hesitant to say which structural changes will take place at the October Vatican Summit. It would defeat the purpose of coming together if there wasn't a sense of unpredictability and also of possibility, McCallum said. Pope Francis understands the synod is more about starting processes than getting immediate results. Reforming seminaries is essential to promote the formation of clergy capable of overcoming differences and finding common ground, according to McCallum. We realize it's a generational process, he said. While this conclusion may seem underwhelming, the synod is not the first step in this process. It builds on the Eastern Orthodox experience of the Synod of Jerusalem in 1672, and the transformations set in motion at the Second Vatican Council of 1962 to 1965, as well as the latest synods under the last three popes. Synodality has already worked before. It has been the witness of bishops already that they change, Luciani said, citing examples of prelates who were transformed in their beliefs during the synods at the Vatican on young people in 2018 and the Pan-Amazonian region in 2019. The Latin American Bishops' Conference, CELAM, has had a head start in its application of synodality. Since before the 2007 Aparecida meeting, where the Cardinal Bergoglio played a key role, the Church in Latin America has engaged laypeople and local communities in lively consultations aimed at promoting shared responsibility and dialogue. Luciani, an expert advisor to CELAM, said this synodal process offers profound insights on how to go back to a model of the Church as the Church of Churches. It's not just about who takes that decision, Luciani said, but about how do we reach that decision together. Pope Francis has gambled to act as an Ignatian spiritual director to 1.2 billion Catholics in the world. If successful, could become a countercultural statement for a new way of reaching decisions that other institutions might take note of. Synodality needs to demonstrate to the world that we have faith that the ultimate truth and goodness that God calls us to is not going to be established by secular power, the kind of power of unilateral control, McCallum said. It's going to be manifest when we express our love and affection for one another with authenticity, when we live with the integrity of our values and beliefs. We have just a bit more time this week on religion in the news, so we'll feature part of this article entitled Greece Begins Giving COVID-19 Vaccines Outside Churches. And this is from the Associated Press by Idili Tsakiri, Dateline Arkanis, Greece. Greece has begun administering vaccinations for COVID-19 outside churches in a pilot program recently announced by the government as a means of encouraging more people to get the shots. Mobile National Health Organization units began administering shots Monday in a churchyard in Arkanis, a town near the city of Heraklion on the southern island of Crete. The single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine was being used, with shots being administered from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. 52 appointments were booked for the first day, but some people were turning up without appointments and were being given the vaccines. The government announced the program last month with mobile health care units to administer shots in town squares outside churches, initially in Crete and later expanding to the country's main cities. Authorities have been seeking to boost Greece's vaccination drive with a series of incentives and have sought the support of the country's powerful Orthodox Church. There is no solution to this great danger ravaging humanity other than the vaccines, said Father Andreas Kalionzakis, priest of the Church of Virgin Mary, outside which Monday's vaccination drive was taking place. It is a one-way street, and as a church, we thought that we have to stand with the people. The church giving its backing was motivation for some to get vaccinated. Local resident Michalis Vardakis, 73, said he got his shot because Father Andreas mediated and he is well respected in Arkanis, and for the sake of my grandchildren, because I cannot stand to be afraid to hug my grandchildren. Well, we've reached the end of our time for this week on Religion in the News. That article obviously was edited a bit for time. We appreciate you tuning in this week and hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available at our website, ncreadingservice.org. We will talk to you next time. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Brian LeBlanc. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.